This week on A to Z Running, we keep talking about this idea of training by effort. And you're likely wondering, does it actually work? And if so, how do you get there? Well, we've got a great way to answer those questions as we kick off a new series right now.
In the world of running, all the talk is about NCAA cross-country championships and the incredible dominance of Parker Velbey.
Also, surprise, running boosts your lifespan. But by how much and how do they know?
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach. And just a reminder that you can learn more about our services and support for runners at A2ZRunning.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, YouTube, Spotify, or if you find us anywhere else, give us a follow.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to share a story that I thought was pretty relatable for a lot of runners. I was talking to a friend and she was saying that she was filling out this health form and I asked her if she sees friends on a regular basis. And at first she's like, oh my word, my life is so busy. And then she remembered that she runs with friends at least once a week. And it got us conversating about how cool it is to have this side-by-side time that's able to help our mental, emotional well-being as well as our physical well-being. So we just love that side-by-side time. And I'm guessing a lot of you all do too.
I also have occasional side-by-side time with a friend. Does this also count? When I go to lift weights, which I do on the regular,
okay.
In the weight room, there's a friend that often is in the same weight room as me. And we sometimes make eye contact and even grunt or nod at one another once in a while.
I mean, does that count? Like that's like a low-key interaction. That's not like a real conversation.
But that is substantial amount of social time for me.
Understandable for you.
I am putting myself out there, even making eye contact.
All right. Well, let's get on to your questions.
Just a quick reminder that we answer one or two questions every week on the podcast now. And so to get a timely response to your question, all you have to do is send it via email to questions@A2ZRunning.com. That email address will get you all the answers to all your questions anytime.
That is a really big claim.
Prove me wrong.
Well, we're answering questions on the podcast for sure. And we love connecting with you whatever way is most convenient. So if you do send me a direct message on Instagram, for instance, this question came from there. We're happy to answer there too. This question comes from Whitney and she asks what we'd recommend for a return to running plan.
All right. Well, we basically approach return to running from a principled standpoint, which I guess we should say we just basically do everything from a principled standpoint. It's just a question of what the principles are. But that being the case, they're also all very unique. And so whatever your individual situation, it has to always be adjusted and adapted with much nuance and preferably with direct support. This is where, you know, your medical people, this is where, if you have a coach, your coach comes into the conversation. Whoever is involved in what you're doing should be involved in this conversation, because if it's difficult to have an objective opinion of ourselves in normal circumstances, it's even harder in abnormal circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that being the case, here are the three principles. And then naturally, we'll highlight them with some anecdote.
Well, first, can I give some examples of the reason it would be different?
Oh, yeah.
Different runners?
Yeah,
okay, there's a few. If there's a few, and this is definitely not extensive, but a few of those things would be how long the person has been injured.
Yeah.
The nature of the injury.
Yeah.
What they were doing previous to that, how much they've been able to do for cross training and other kinds of strength building while they're injured.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally.
Go ahead.
What's worked for them in the past and maybe some perpetual things that they can see from previous experience.
Yes. And how big a fool they be in right now.
Are you talking to me?
No.
Okay, good. So I am currently in this experience, but I'll get to that in a minute before we want to get to the principles first.
Andy's doing a major comeback. And in fact, Zach's doing a minor comeback as well right now. So we'll highlight a few different examples, in fact, to give you a sense of that difference. So key number one, or principle number one, if you will. We always recommend in every circumstance, but returning from injury is probably even more so the case, that you only ever do the next level based on how you're responding to the current level. So how your body is handling what you're doing right now determines when and how much and whether you make any changes. And that's important because, especially when you're returning from something like an injury, you're having to rebuild broken things, right? Whether it's a broken energy system, whether it's a broken, like literal something in your body that was broken, or otherwise broken routine, like all those things, right? You're having to rebuild from that state. And in so doing that, things tend to break in small ways unexpectedly as you're doing this. And so the major issue may be healed, but small things and other exigent circumstances are always coming and going, and the most so when we're coming from a state of disruption. So we have to be cautious and careful. That's the first principle. Number two, focus on being strong and moving well first before you think about building up training. And that, of course, is a part of building up training. But the point is, you need your body to be strong enough to handle more, whatever that more is, and you need to be able to move well, comfortably, and accurately, like correctly, as best as possible. Because when you move well, you tend to also stay healthier and not hurt things as much. So that's good. And then the last one is avoiding extremes. We just say this about everything, but just never do anything until you're ready for it. And generally, if it's, you know, something quite a bit different than what you've been doing, it's too much. It's too different. So a little bit different is good. A lot of it different is high risk, very low reward.
Yeah. So if you wanted to incorporate some cross training, for instance, it should be a cross training. If you're going to do it like more than 30 minutes, it should be a cross training that you've done before. So you wouldn't want to incorporate, because you're super excited to get back to things like, what's a good example? I guess rowing for an hour.
Like Andy did?
No. Blistered. I was only able to do a short while because my body told me so.
Hands were bloody by the end of it.
It's true. It actually was true. But what I'm saying is that's also a consideration. So like extreme, that's an example. Yeah. You don't want to hop into some other kind of thing that you haven't been doing in a large quantity. You want to be gentle with yourself in all the things. And you know, maybe you haven't been doing strength. And you know, to be a healthy runner, you need to incorporate strength. Well, that doesn't mean that you're going to go hit the gym really hard and do a huge session when you haven't been doing strength training yet.
Well,
so you have to be
unless
gentle.
You want to be hurt again with something else.
So that was my example.
Yeah. So there's a lot of layers then, of course, to that. But those are the principles that guide our decision making. And then to your question, Whitney, what's our plan, our return to running plan? From those principles, it is always different for every person. We have never had the same situation for any two runners returning from any kind of major disruption. So it's going to potentially include some of these other elements. And this is where we get into like, what are the different kinds of parts and pieces that are involved in achieving those principles, right? Oftentimes we use run-walk approaches because building strength is key, moving well is key, but we can't do too much. And so we do things like 3 minutes of jogging, 1 minute of walking for 30 minutes. That's obviously not a lot of running all told, but you get that kind of that constant disruption, which is very helpful for a number of reasons. And it's a very minimal stress on your system to do something like that. And you'd build that up over time.
And it's more time that you're moving as well, which is a benefit.
It is, in fact. Doing all the things that, like the rehabilitative things, beyond the protocol limits. Like the idea of, it seems like you're healed, you don't have to do that stuff anymore. Well, it might be a good idea to still do it. And if you're not doing exactly like the rehabilitation protocol that you were given, doing functional movement exercises, which is probably a large part of what you were doing with that protocol, those things absolutely need to continue to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I will want to reiterate, like, only increasing on your body's ability to handle each step. Mm-hmm. And it might be frustrating. So,
yep.
Speaking from experience.
Yep. And that's where it's like, you know, there's going to be a situation. For example, your coach says, all right, this week, let's try these things. You get, you know, halfway into it and it's clear based on how your body's responding that that's not great. Well, just because your coach said it at the beginning of the week doesn't mean you should continue doing it when you're not handling it well. Best scenario there is you reach out to your coach and say, this isn't going super well. What should I do? Mm. And certainly being willing to make those kinds of decisions at any moment along the way. Because when it comes down to it, you're returning from a major disruption, whatever the cause of the disruption, the key is not getting back as soon as possible. That's a recipe for disaster. The key is getting back, however long it takes, whatever that looks like, mm-hmm. getting there. Okay, Andy.
So how's I promised sharing my situation. So
as a case study,
yeah,
for what to do and not to do, or just what to do.
Well,
you do.
I'll give you both.
Yeah,
I guess.
Okay. All right.
I do run walk when I start back from injury. Well, lately I have, because they've been significant. So my most recent injury, I was not able to run for 13 weeks, which is substantial. And during that time, I was not able to cross train in my normal ways. And so I was at one of my weakest points. Even after my hip surgeries, I was still able to move and do quite a bit. But this specific injury was horrible. I was in pain with any of those movements. So I came from a very weak point. So I did the run walk, and I had to run just little bits at a time and see. And there's my first 2 weeks back to running, I probably ran a total of 20 minutes.
At what point were you just basically just running in place?
Oh,
you did a lot of that.
I did do that. That was, yes.
So Andy found, I got to give the outsider perspective. Andy discovered with the nature of this injury, it was a scenario. This is what we do with these kinds of injuries. We test movements and you try to find a movement that does not aggravate anything. Not just while you're doing it, but also how do you feel the rest of the day or the next day. And she discovered eventually with a lot of trial and error that if she did this kind of like little mini jogging in place, basically, like without really trying to propel herself forward, that it did not bother her injury site. So Andy would go, we'd like go to a playground with the kids, and Andy would spend like half an hour to an hour jogging around this playground, and it would take her like half an hour to just make one loop around the playground.
I don't want to brag, but I ran a slower mile than Molly Seidel's
world record. Andy was deciding, can I run the slowest mile?
If anybody tried to do it, they'd be able to as well. But that's besides the point. The point really is that I didn't allow for my return to running to be uncomfortable, like to be painful in the way that I knew was going to be setting me back. So I found some things to do that they weren't really building me up aerobically, unfortunately.
Well, they usually aren't at the early stages. It's just strength.
Just strength.
Try to strengthen your system.
Yep. And then I bumped up to continuous running once I was able to run without any pain, and my stride didn't have to be a certain way in order to not experience pain. And I was doing like 20 to 30 minute runs every other day. And that took a while for me to build from there. I don't remember how many weeks it was, but it was based on my body's responses. And so now I'm up to 5 or 6 days a week, and I'll likely be looking at having something official. But right now it's pretty unstructured, depending on how I feel each day. So I have a lot of things with like my, because of my hips, there's some like achiness and things. So I measure what I need to do based on that. And I want to feel good when I'm running. That's my goal. I just want to run free. That's most of our goals, I think, to be able to enjoy and do this sport that we love so much.
How did you decide yesterday you were going to go for a run? You wanted to go for a little bit longer run, but you weren't sure earlier in the day. You were saying you weren't feeling great. How did you decide that you're feeling good enough to go for a little bit longer run? Or did you make a bad choice?
No, it actually was the right choice for
good,
me.
Good.
I decided I'd just go out and start moving. And if things started feeling better, I would continue. If things got worse, I would stop.
Okay.
That's been kind of a theme for me. A lot of times I will go and I will start, and it's pretty evident, like when things get worse, that you should stop. So,
yeah.
And it's very interesting because there are a lot of times that things start to feel better and more smooth. And so because I have joint issues, so joints like to move and they start feeling better as you go sometimes. So I've had to learn that. But also not be stubborn. If like there's something that's kind of like lingering and holding on, I'm like, maybe it will disappear. So there is a lot of keeping an eye on things that I have to do while I'm running.
Yeah. There's a bit of that.
Yep.
Well, there you go. That's a good example of the nuance and complexity of these things, because that's not a situation that's identical to anyone else's.
It's true.
It's true. So on a minor scale situation, I'll just note in the last 2 years, both of the last 2 years, I've had some kind of injury that has required me to take some time off and then rebuild slowly based on the nature of the injury. It was sometimes not too long and other times longer. But point being, so that's probably the most common scenario that we get when we're talking to people about disruptions. And the way it goes in those situations is often similar in the sense that, you know, the first thing I did is I would just jog for like 15 minutes one day and just kind of see how that felt, make sure that it didn't cause any discomfort the next day. It's never really a good idea to say, oh, I'm actually feeling really good, I'll go out and try to run for an hour, because you might feel great for that entire hour, and then the next week you can't hardly walk without pain. And that's the way these kinds of injuries often work. So you have to be cautious in how we test ourselves. But jog a few times throughout one of the weeks. In the meantime, spending a lot of time in the weight room, doing a lot of the strength work. I've got my mobile board from DeSherry and his group. It's just a wonderful asset. Not at all trying to push that for sales right now, because we don't get anything if you were to go out and buy it right now. But that's one example of many that is certainly a great asset for building lower leg and foot strength and intuition. And then doing all that kind of work, the core stuff to make sure that posture is working as I'm running. And so then when I go out and I start actually building up volumes, everything feels sturdy. Everything feels like it's moving well. And I'm only running like 20 minutes, but it feels really good. That's the goal, right? That's the point. And then if I can get through, you know, a week where I'm just jogging here and there, maybe it's every other day, maybe it's every day, kind of just depends. Then the next week I try to actually layer in a little bit of volume and see how I respond to that. And the week after that, I either, depending on how that went, do about the same thing or add a little bit more volume. And then after I can get 2 or 3 weeks of increasing volume a notch here and there, then you know that basically your system is handling it. And then you can try to start looking toward what does it look like to ease back into my kind of regular training cadence. And that's a pretty common layout. The key to all of that is that strength work in the early stages, because when you don't do that, then your body's doing everything at once. You're trying to build the strength while you're increasing the training volume. And it's just hard on the body to do that. So Whitney, thank you for asking. Unfortunately, we can't just hand you a clear cookie cutter on this, but whenever do we hand anyone a clear cookie cutter on anything? The key are the principles. Mm-hmm. So let's summarize those here really quickly for you. Number one, make sure to only increase based on how you are responding to the current level of training. Number two, focus on being strong and moving well before you ever start thinking about increasing running training. And number three, avoid extremes and don't do things unless you're ready for them. Hmm. That's it.
Good stuff.
Well, let's get on now to something helpful. So as we teased in the introduction, we have been talking ad nauseum to some about this principle of training by effort. And if anything, you know, go back and listen to episode 136 to get our kind of our full explanation of how to train by effort. That I believe is that our highest downloaded episode ever.
It might be.
It's number one. It's number one. No, not anymore. Okay. This one's number one or number two.
Okay.
But there's a reason for that. So we're not saying that doesn't mean anything to you. You don't know how many downloads we get on our episodes. The point is, there's a reason that episode is one of, if not our most listened to episode. And that's because that content is what's defining when we talk about intuitive running and training. How do we do that is really challenging. And so it helps for all of us to get some clear explanations of those things. We read a lot of material from a lot of running authors on these topics for that very reason. Well, we're not going to answer that question right now, how to train by effort. We'll summarize it briefly in a moment. But what we're going to do with this series is we are trying to bring to you the perspectives of how to then actually, in practice, achieve that. So we've given you the principles, but what does that actually look like when a runner is doing the thing? Because it's difficult. And so what are the challenges we experience and face in trying to do that? What are the benefits? What are the obstacles? What are the successes? And so here's what we're going to do. This week, we're going to just lay it out for you, kind of give you the explanation of the approach we take when we're supporting runners or trying to coach a runner to move in the direction of intuitive training. And then for the next however many weeks we have them, we're going to share with you interviews with runners and their experiences with these training principles. And it's going to be awesome because you're going to get all sorts of different explanations of the experiences. They're not all the same. And some have had a really great experience and a really like seamless time integrating these kinds of things. And others have found it very challenging. And
but still had results.
Well, I'm not to say that it can't still be positive, even if it's very challenging.
Yeah.
The point is, these things are complicated. And how better to navigate those challenges but to talk in context with the people who are doing the stuff. So we're going to bring that to you. More on that next week. Right now, what we want to do is kind of lay that foundation, starting with a very brief summary of what we mean when we're talking about how to train by effort. So first on the list, you have to learn the distinction between how I feel and how much I exert. We talk about that all the time. How I feel is not the same thing as how hard I am running, but how hard I am running produces a certain feeling. And so we've got to be able to separate the two and understand how they interact with each other to achieve that goal.
The really cool thing about that too, I want to say, separating how I feel with how much I'm actually exerting is that you can learn how to feel better while you're running at higher efforts. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure.
So
keep going.
Yeah, because a lot of times we equate our effort by how good we feel.
Yes.
Right? But in actuality, so for instance, I used to think that I was running easy when I was not. Because I would run with friends or I would just be rolling and I felt so good.
Well, that was the comfortable rhythm. That was the comfortable rhythm you had always had.
Yeah. But the effort was higher than I was really accepting. But that realization allowed for me to replicate how I felt. So I would choose for situations that I would need to run a higher effort, or in races I could put myself in that frame.
Mm-hmm.
And it also was good to know that I can run high efforts and it can feel good.
Mm. Okay.
Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense. There's a lot involved in that.
There is a lot involved in that because feelings are deceiving.
But in principle, we gotta figure that out. We have to be able to feel and exert in those kinds of ways. So that's a piece of the puzzle. Now, we do talk about using data. And there are data that are helpful in learning these kinds of distinctions, but we are an intuition-first approach. And so our goal is to be able to do the thing without the data and then have the data to inform us for the next time we do the thing, is kind of the way we view that, if at all. Now, you're going to hear Zach talking lately about maybe we should throw all the data out. And that's
extremist.
I am a bit of an extremist at times. And the reason I'm about that perspective often is because the data cause so many problems for so many runners. I don't know why we're trying to mess with it then. So if they are causing you problems, get rid of those data. And so throw out the watch. And it doesn't have to be permanent. This doesn't have to be a long-term solution. A good example is a runner. I've said this story before, but a runner that I coached in high school went on to run collegiately, and very successful high school athlete. Great success collegiately, but he was having trouble kind of getting to a next level. He had reached a point where it's like it's kind of stagnating, not necessarily stagnating, but just couldn't quite move beyond that, right? And he's telling me, like, I don't know what the issue is. Like, he's doing all the stuff in training and everything looks like he's in X capacity and capability, but then the race results just aren't coming. And then, you know, there's other scenarios involved. And so one of the comments I said finally was, you know what, pick a summer. And so I'm not his college coach, right? So I'm not going to try to tell him what to do anywhere contrary to what his college coach is. But instead, there was an area that I could suggest that fit fine with what his college coach was doing, which is, this summer, in the middle of the summer, when you're just kind of doing your solo conditioning stuff, don't ever wear your watch. For 1 month, no watch. And he did it. And I'm not saying it solved all his problems, but it helped in a lot of ways. And maybe solved all his problems. No, I'm kidding. But so that, you know, that's where it's like, okay. And then he went on to kind of doing what he normally did after that. And it helped, but it helped get over a certain kind of situation in that moment. So the data are causing us problems in many instances, and we have to be able to recognize when they are helping and when they are not, and what we should do.
We don't want our data to tell us how we feel or to tell us how we're exerting, right?
Right.
So oftentimes people have, and we've talked about this in several podcasts, people have reactions negatively to the feedback that they're getting from their watch. And whether they're running too fast or too slow or whatever the data may be that doesn't match, it's called the mismatch theory. If it doesn't match what you think it's going to be, it causes a reaction.
Yep.
So it's typically not positive. So if we can avoid doing so and really tune in to what we need to tune into, we can have greater success. I've had greater success running without a watch in races than I ever did looking at my watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you remembered the name of that. I always forget it and I'm always racking my brain. What is it? A mismatch theory, that's what it's called. Yes, we need to stop letting that happen by our deliberate actions. And that's one consideration. So that's a piece of the puzzle. We talk about that quite a bit. And then as noted here, then understanding how to exert exactly the right amount of effort for today's goal, to achieve that goal. When we can do that, then we can get what we need to get out of every single training run every single time. With some exceptions, but some exclusions may apply. However, the point is, if we can do that and replicate it, then we're in the sweet spot. We're in the zone for training. However, there's also the question of how to exert exactly as much as is available that day to give a full effort.
That's for racing.
That's race day. And that's another layer that is not solved by achieving layer number one. We've got to do some other things, because just because I know how to exert to give that kind of effort I need to give today for training does not mean that I know what it means to achieve maximum possible effort over any given distance. Very tricky, right? You're going to have situations where it's like, I can execute a 5K race like no problem every time, very consistent, always feel like I did the most I could do that day. But then I go to run a half marathon and I'm lost. I got no idea where I'm at. I'm ping ponging. One day I'm running great and then tank. Another day I finish and think I've got so much left. Well, anyway, those are challenges. That's a big piece in the puzzle. And then the last note here is that it's all of this is highly nuanced, because when it comes down to it, it has everything to do with knowing what's going on right now and how to respond to that in any given moment, which means it's not just the physiology of training. It's also the mental and cognitive strain and stress on my life in general. It's also the emotional burden I'm carrying. It's my state of mind and everything else involved. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult. Now, that is a brief summary of when we talk about how to train by effort. Those are the things involved. If you want to know how to address those things well, go back to episode 136. Listen to that one. We talk about it in more substance there. Mm-hmm. For now, what we want to do is now set the stage for our series we're going to be sharing with you in terms of our approach as coaches when we help someone navigate these challenges. So it's not necessarily the broad principles of how to implement these things, but how do we help a person achieve those goals? Mm-hmm. And we've basically got a few key steps. Yeah. Not that this is a super simple or linear process, but these are the things. Down. Yeah, if we could.
Yeah. Step one, we help runners learn how we should feel at different levels of effort for different durations.
So we will tell a runner, jog. And jog means blank, this kind of minimal effort.
And jog serves this purpose.
Yeah.
Because running by effort is only possible if our athletes understand why we are doing the training that we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because otherwise you fall into that rut of, well, I'm feeling really good or I'm feeling really bad today, so I'm going to change the plan. Well, you should rarely ever change the plan just because you're feeling differently than expected. Now, that's not to say if you are feeling really bad, then there's a good chance you should change the plan. But if we shouldn't be making decisions in the sense of like, this is how I'm feeling, so I'm going to do this thing. It's more like, this is what I should be achieving today. And in light of that, based on how I'm feeling, I should do this thing. So the purpose is key. Now, we're talking at length with our runners about why are we doing the things we're doing in training. I wish we could talk about it even more, but we don't always have a lot of time, constant conversations with people. Instead, it's a question of what are we trying to do right now in this moment, and how should we be feeling while we're doing it? And this is the key, because you say something like, an easy run should be 50 to 70% of maximum effort for a given distance. And then the runner comes back and says, well, how does that feel? That's a good question to ask, because if you don't know how it feels, chances are you're going to have a really hard time finding the right level of effort. So we have to have answers to that question. And we do. So we're going to talk with runners about, if you're doing this workout this day, here's how you should be feeling while you're doing that. And then we say to runners almost every time, we say, now go out and try it and then tell us how it felt. And we'll talk about what you should do differently next time. Because that brings us to step number two, which we'll get to in a moment. But we have a constant, it's an ongoing process conversation. Now remember, that's not actually the final goal though. Knowing how I feel on the different efforts or how I should feel is only the step toward the final goal, which is knowing how much to exert to produce that feeling. And that's what we were saying earlier. So that's what we're going to say. How do you produce that feeling? How much do you exert in that sense? before we get to that, a quick note here that we do also talk quite a bit about our runners, about the other influences. And so, you know, how are you feeling in terms of like level of stress and anxiety in life in general, that's going to influence some of this, how well rested you are, all the stuff, right?
And going back to the question earlier, when you're returning back from an injury or something, for instance, your systems might feel great. You actually might be in decent aerobic condition if you've been cross training, things of that nature, but you're going to have to manage what you're doing in training in light of potential musculoskeletal weaknesses or other vulnerabilities that you have. So being intuitive isn't just exerting the effort, but it's also knowing what is going to be okay for you in the step in the process for your whole body, your systems, and your musculoskeletal structure.
Yeah, so there's three systems that we're always targeting in terms of physiology of training: the musculoskeletal, the aerobic, and the neuromuscular, and they're very rarely aligned. And so you have one that's way higher than another, and it creates a really strange discrepancy in terms of how then you train. So people say to us, well, I felt really good, but I was really sore the next day. And it's like, okay, so one of those systems is in a better place than another one, and we need to address them properly. This is also why we address things in a certain order, because you have to have a strong structure before you can push your aerobic system well. And that's where you get into a situation where it's like, oh, aerobically, I felt great. So I was really feeling like I could go faster and push harder. And then the next day I was super sore. That's because your musculoskeletal structure, your musculoskeletal system was not able to handle that level of effort, even though you felt good. So this is why the nuance is so high. This is why we have to be talking in an ongoing conversation with a runner to really truly implement this. But why it also becomes the case that you need to know the exertional component ultimately. It's not about how you feel. That just helps you learn the process. It's really about how much you're exerting. Because at the end of the day, you'll know, I might be feeling great, but I should only be exerting up to this point, and I should not exceed that, even if it feels fine to do so. And there's reasons, and I need to be on board with those reasons. And if I am, then I can implement that better. So that's step number two, helping our runners to learn how to produce that feeling based on how much we exert. And this is the hardest part. And I say it that way from two perspectives. One, personally, in my own implementation and training. So part of that one is also, this is an area that you don't find a lot of material about. And I'm not quite sure why. I think I actually am. I have a hypothesis why. I have a theory.
Ooh, okay, let's hear it.
Well, it's basically this. This is almost impossible to explicitly articulate. How much do you exert at any given level of effort? That's where they get, like, they have those percent systems and stuff. But that doesn't, no one knows what 50% exertion means. And so how do you, like, create clarity on that? And the answer is, you really can't. Not conceptually. You can only create clarity in practice over time, and that's why it's so difficult. So that's the other layer of it, is with our runners, or not just our runners, but any runners that we've talked to about these things, when we start talking about this idea of exerting so much up to a certain point or within a certain range for an effort level, that is not something that most runners have any clear sense of naturally. We have to contrive it. And there's only really one way to do that. Trial and error. Repeating efforts over time.
And also having a process for which you are evaluating these things. When we were doing our conversation with Steve Magnus's book, what was that called again?
The Science of Running book?
No, or the other one.
The Passion Paradox book?
Mm-mm.
We've read a lot of his books. I don't
anyway,
know which one you're talking
so
about.
So the idea is that you name the things that you are feeling. so that you can create these pathways that you know and can identify what's going on. So for instance, I am feeling fatigued. I'm drained. I feel upset. And I go for my run and I'm thinking, man, my body, like, I just feel bad. Well, to identify what is feeling bad and to identify what I can do in that run exertionally based on the whole, I can say, oh, well, that is not my, that's not a running thing. And I can like put it to the side. Okay, that burden I'm carrying, I don't need to carry right now. Oh, maybe I'm just feeling a little bit like down and I can lift my body up. Because my posture was reflecting my sadness or something. So I guess yeah. What I'm saying is that you learn to label things in a way that's purposeful and helpful and being intuitive in your run. Because just because you feel terribly during the day doesn't mean that you're going to have a bad run. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that. And maybe you'll start and you need to start with a longer warm up if you have a workout day. Maybe it takes longer to get into the right zone and to be in a space where you can understand what's going on with your body and have the right effort. But that is part of the building intuition is being able to notice things that are going on in your body.
Yeah.
And mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are certain things we certainly can do in training that just kind of help with creating these senses. A good example of this is something like the fartlek workout, which is, it's kind of like a low stakes opportunity to play with efforts, because our goal with the fartlek workout is to experience the full spectrum of exertional efforts. And so you want to have moments where you're going as hard as you can go, if you're able to handle that at that time, reasonably, right? No extremes, but as hard as you can go within reason. And so like, what does it feel like to be at a dead sprint? And then also, what does it feel like to be like one notch above just really easy running and do that for a while? But you're never pushing the limit. You're always stopping the effort before you reach any kind of limit of how long you could sustain that effort. So if I'm at a dead sprint, I'm only gonna do it for like 5 seconds. And if I'm at like a good, strong, steady effort, I might do it for 5 minutes, but I could do it for an hour if I really wanted to. And so you see the difference here. And then there's, of course, everything in between. So there's ways of accelerating the trial and error here. And so if the whole point is repeating efforts over time and creating a sense of what's too much, what's too little, be smart about our workouts. Something like a fartlek can create more opportunities, more frequency of opportunities to generate that sense in one single workout.
And if you do overdo it, you're just done. You're done for the day.
You can just be done as soon as you need to be. Yep.
You can.
Which is great. It's low stakes. Nice. It is nice.
We also have time trials, which really help you hone things and get your efforts correct.
Yeah. So there's a min-max scenario with all of this. And when you can establish those with clarity, the middle is much easier to find. And so what I mean by that is and this is kind of, it feeds into our final step here as we're working with the runner, but we establish the minimum lowest level possible of effort, of exertion to call it running, right? That's like jogging and in the worst
we
way.
We love jogging.
Yeah, I do. I mean, literally, I very much enjoy it personally.
I am a jogger and I'm proud of it. People always would say like jogger versus runner. Joggers are runners. It's just your exertion. It's lower.
Right.
If you're running in a jog, then it's a jog. But if it's a higher exertion, it's running, no matter what pace that is for a person.
What if you never run harder than a jog? Are you still a runner or are you a jogger? Bad question, because they're the same thing. But
you're both at the same time.
The point is that's the minimum. We established the minimum. And we have a lot of runners who are like, why would I do this? And it's like, well, for one, because we're going to try to increase your volume. And the best way to increase volume is at low levels of effort. But also, because that's creating some clarity. I know what it feels like to exert almost nothing. Okay. Now, over time, we also establish the maximum. Because before you ever get to important races, you need to know what it feels like to exert at the highest possible level for a given distance. And so we'll use other kinds of workouts like time trials or actual races and rehearse the race experience. And that's step three. We need to rehearse and execute these things. We can't just practice it at a conceptual level and kind of do some trial and error and then go into our race scenarios and just always do what we were going to do before for races. Now, a lot of runners are going to do that. It's a comfort thing. This is the way I want to try to run the race. But at the end of the day, I also want to be moving toward a sense that I can execute any level of effort for any given distance. And the most important one of all of them is the performative one, if my goal is to perform at some point in my season. And so the only way to do that is to do it and to try it in practice, which is tricky. So what it comes down to is we're trying to work with a runner to achieve this intuitive sense. And in order to accomplish that, we have to go through some of these key steps in a process approach, because it just doesn't come naturally for most of us. Now, that said, it actually does come naturally for some, and it's just really quite amazing to see that. It didn't for me, and certainly didn't for Andy. Can I speak for you?
certainly not.
That's okay. But whatever it may be for a given runner, these are the steps that you can see how hands-on this kind of an approach is. Whether it's with a coach, whether it's with other running friends, and we're talking about it together, that's a great approach to developing these kinds of things too. And all told, just trying to be able to get to the sense of knowing what I can exert at any given moment. And I should provide the caveat, because Andy was saying it earlier and I forgot to make the connection then, but it's not just about, like, so you say, okay, how am I feeling today is not the thing that should decide it. It's how much I can exert. But what you get is you get this sense of, as I am exerting, I can tell whether it's too much or too little for where I am today. And that's the key, because whatever's going on in life, whatever's happening to me physiologically, mentally, and emotionally, and all the other stuff, it's just not going to produce the same results one day versus another. And so understanding that when I am exerting, I have some options available to me. I can exert more and less, and I should do that deliberately at all times to get to the right zone or area. But also, I can change what I'm doing in terms of how I'm exerting. And that's, Andy talks about this so much and so articulately, that we can feel better without doing anything more than changing how we're moving. And wouldn't that be nice? And so that matters. And we can address those things too. We talk about that. So what we're going to do here, we've given you kind of a sense of how we approach this with runners. Now, don't take our word for it. We're going to bring runners on the show who have worked through some amount of time, and some have done this for a substantial amount of time, and some have only done it for a short amount of time. And that's part of the beauty of doing something like this. We're going to bring them on here in the coming weeks to share with you how they have navigated these things and how they have been able to navigate them to a point of success, or where some of those challenges and obstacles have come along the way. And then you'll find out if it actually works.
It's been a really great journey for us personally. So maybe we should share our stories at some point too. But it's a really freeing thing to be able to run based on what you're able to give and what is required for you for adaptations. Because oftentimes runners don't realize that they're exerting more than they even need to in order to get the adaptations for specific running. I mean, there are times that you do need to exert, but that's not always. So it's a combination. Running by effort is a combination of knowing yourself and being able to feel the exertion and be able to hone that, but also understanding training. So that's why we created A to Z Running, because we believe that we're all better runners understanding the sport better and doing it in community and sharing our stories.
And what better way, except for with us?
Well, we sure appreciate it. Well, we have more to talk about today, but it's going to be about the world of running.
Starting off with a few updates from A to Z Runners doing the thing. Craig ran the Route 66 Marathon. and had a funny note to share about the race. Given that it's called the Route 66 Marathon, one would expect, incorrectly, that you spend a decent amount of time on Route 66, the roads. But in fact, he said it was very, very brief moment in time, like maybe even like hundreds of meters at most. So that's kind of funny. But great work, Greg.
Good job, Craig.
And Mallory ran the Philadelphia Marathon.
She said that her medal actually rang. It has a bell on it and it rings.
And it tinkles.
I don't think that's the right word. I don't think that's the right word.
If it's a little bell.
Jingles.
It's a tinkling bell.
No,
right?
I don't think so. All right.
Allie ran the Western Michigan University Turkey Trot 5K.
Third overall.
Nice work, mm-hmm. Allie. Ben ran the longest running race in Michigan.
Not in like length of race.
But having gone on for the most consecutive years.
Which is 56 years.
56 years mm-hmm. and going strong, the Dowagiac Turkey Trot 5K. Just doing kind of like a fun thing with his kid. So that's fun. Nice work.
Very cool. Next up, the NCAA Cross Country Championships. We're going to start with the women.
Oh my goodness.
Zach is super excited.
There's so much to talk about with this event.
He spent an unreasonable amount of time digesting this stuff.
It was only a weekend.
A weekend.
And a day.
Well, let's start off with what everyone's been talking about. And I'm sure if you have a pulse on any running news, this is the big thing that's been popping up.
Valby Mania.
Parker Valby. See, Zach's so excited. She won in a very dominant fashion.
Valby Mania is like a thing, right?
I didn't know this. You're probably like president.
That's
of
just
fan
what
club
everyone keeps
something.
Talking about. No, I certainly am not, because there's a lot of people that are a lot more knowledgeable of this fan club than I am. And it's probably a social media thing, which is why I don't really know what it is. But the point is, Parker Valby's got a bit of a following. And for some time now, people have been like, when is it going to finally happen? Well, last outdoor track, if you recall, she won the 5,000 meters. But a lot of people were like, well, Caitlin Tuohy should have won that race if she was like there and on. But she like kind of was falling apart at the end of the season and having a rough patch. And so then it was kind of like a question. Well, Parker Valby put away all doubt this cross-country season in dominant. So, all right.
She won every race, right?
Yes. Let's Run founders are making the claim, or I guess they're kind of softly making the claim, that this may have been the greatest collegiate cross-country season by a woman ever.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
That's bold. But why are they making that claim? Well, first of all, she did win the NCAA championships. That's a piece of the puzzle. She also won every race she ran this season. Now, she only ran four races. This is a normal thing for college cross-country runners. They run like a couple times.
What? I feel like I raced like twice a week.
Yes, but you did not run in the NCAA. You were just running in this small division with all of the rest of us. All right, so we did basically run like every weekend for a long time. And it was fun. I liked it. But they don't. They run like four times. And so Parker Valby ran four races. She won all of them. Not only did she win all of them, she set a course record in every single one.
Not too shabby.
Including the Nuddycombe, the famous Nuddycombe course, which everyone under the sun has run in the last 20, 30 years. And so we're talking about the most legendary cross-country runners that the NCAA has ever seen have been running on this course. And Parker Valby broke all of their course records and did it on a terrible day. Conditions were bad. And she still smashed the course record.
Wow.
So everyone's like, what? When she did that? Not only that, Caitlin Tuohy was in that race. Parker Valby beat her by like 15 seconds.
Which race?
Nuddycombe.
Okay, Nuddycombe. Okay.
So it's like, okay, what is going on here? Something's happening. Well, then the doubters were like, yeah, but you know, give Caitlin Tuohy the championship. She'll be there. Well, she wasn't there.
But
I will talk about it.
Yeah.
But Parker Valby not only won the NCAA championships, not only set a course record on Virginia's course, which is a challenging course, she broke the NCAA championship record as well on a challenging hilly course. Like, they've run some crazy fast courses in the NCAA championships. Virginia's not one of them, and she broke the championship record.
Wow.
She won by 10 seconds. which sounds like it's not crazy. At one point in the race, she had a 20-second lead in the middle of the race. Mm. She was just putting it down, start to finish. Well, it took her a while to actually get to the front because she apparently got boxed in. In her post-race interview, she had a lot to say about that. She said it very quickly. It's kind of hard to understand and follow. But she said a lot of words to the extent of she was panicking a bit in the early race. Like, oh my goodness, I can't get up there because she was trapped. Well, she got up there. And then she kept going and never stopped going until she won the race.
Wow.
That was something. So you decide. Is that the greatest NCAA collegiate season to date by a female? I think so. I think so. No one else has done quite like that. But it's hard to compare.
Very impressive. I have to say, I think it might be because she ended up being caught just a little bit, right?
Yeah.
She still won by 10
seconds.
They
were gaining on her in the last K or so. Yeah.
Do you think that her being a little frantic made her push a little too hard early on?
No, I think that's what she was going to do no matter what.
Okay.
It is what she did last year, if you recall. But Caitlin Tuohy ended up reeling her in and caught her late in the race.
Hmm.
It's also what she did at every single race this season. So no one was surprised.
All right. Well, we have to remember that Caitlin Tuohy is also – she did a lot of things last year that were really exciting. That
breaking all sorts of collegiate records.
Breaking records, but then also competing against really great professionals as yep. well. Had extra season on top of her collegiate season. So it was very impressive. Well, Tuohy was not healthy at this race.
So it turns out she came down with an illness the day before the race. Probably a puking sickness of some kind based on how they were describing, although no one went into detail. But so Tui's sick for the national championships, still goes out and runs it. Apparently, some witnesses said she was puking midway through the race. So, like, this girl's sick and still finished fifth. And in fact, at one point in the middle of the race, she was like 11th or 12th. She actually rallied to gain on a bunch of people and finish fifth. Well, ill, and well, then straight Ill. To the medical tent after
right.
finishing.
But she did it for her team.
Well, yeah. When there's so much on the line, which we're about to get to, the team scenario. Why did Tuohy do that when, you know, she didn't clearly need to? This is probably Tui's last collegiate race. Everyone's saying she's going pro. She doesn't have to yet. She has more eligibility. But, yeah, she's probably going pro.
It's a year she probably wants to spend on the track getting ready for Olympic trials, I would guess.
Which is why this would be the time to do it.
Yeah.
Unless she can't get as good of a contract.
So you're thinking she won't do indoor and outdoor?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think so.
So she'll go into training for Olympic trials.
That's what I think.
Go pro.
Yep. But that's only because that's what everyone's saying and it just seems likely. Point being, this was kind of supposed to be like the big rematch between the two. Yeah. Caitlin Tuohy won last year. Valby was second. Valby won Nuddycombe this year and over Tuohy, and it was kind of like, oh, is the national championship, what's gonna happen? And it just didn't come together for, you know, the illness, who knows what it would have looked like minus that. But the point being, Tuohy did she did her job, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So rounding out the top five, just to note here, in second place was Doris Lemgol from Alabama. She's a freshman, new to the NCAA from Kenya here, and was second to Valby as well in the conference championship, the SECs. But she was quite a bit closer in the national championship here and gaining on her substantially in the end. So it's kind of like, oh, the more this girl runs the more this girl races in the NCAA, the better she's
woman,
getting.
Woman, not girl.
I know. And so that was exciting. And Olivia Markezic, who from Notre Dame was the steeplechase champion last year, if you remember, Andy. She finished third. Big time for cross country.
Good for her.
Yes.
Steeplechasers seem to do well in cross country.
It's often the case. Yeah. And then in fourth was Hilda Olamomoy, also from Alabama. So Alabama had that tough 1-2 punch, second and fourth. This is her second season, second cross-country season in NCAA. Last year she was sixth, so she's moving up a notch at a time. And then Tuohy was in fifth, as noted.
So the team race. Zach was not wanting to share this before the end.
I didn't want to give it away.
But the winner, NC State.
So this is why Tui was willing to push through so much. Because NC State, two championship titles in a row, was going for their third, probably Tui's last season, and they were down their second runner. Their number two, Kelsey Camille, was injured, and they announced 3 days before the meet that she wasn't going to be racing. And everyone's like, oh my goodness, there's no way they can do it. NAU, Northern Arizona University, is currently ranked number one coming into the race, and they deserved it. They were dominant all season. And so for NC State to be able to pull off this title was already an uphill battle. And then Kelsey Camille's down with injury, and she's like top five national finisher. Like, she's not just their number two runner. She's top five overall, and she's out. And then Caitlin Tui's sick come race day. Like, it's all falling apart around them. And so Tui is grinding through the worst of it in this race. She only, quote, only finishes fifth. And yet, NC State wins the meet over NAU by 1 point. Woo. In cross country, that's one person.
That's amazing.
You pass one person. NC State or NAU passes two people, they win the race. They pass one person, they win it in a tiebreaker, because they also would have won if it came down to tiebreaker. So NC State had one path to victory, and it wasn't Caitlin Tui by herself. She's not the only one who put the team on her back, but she definitely put the team
Very
on her
impressive.
Back in her way. And yeah. Then what else was going on there? Because how do they do this? How do they do this without Camille? There's no way NC State wins this race without Camille. Well, Amaris Tanisma, who is a transfer this year to NC State, in a big way showed up. She actually has not finished a race this season. She's dropped out of every race she's done for different reasons. Who knows exactly what and why, but the point is, it's a huge question mark. She's for sure the top five on their team if she finishes a race. Well, not only is she top five on their team, she's second for their team. She's 25th overall.
That's impressive.
So she put the team on her back. But then they had a pair of freshmen rounding out their top five for fourth and fifth on the team, Leah Steffens and Grace Hartman, both finishing very high up, true freshmen doing the thing, and that's always tough to do, especially on a dynastic team like NC State right now. So they did it. They pull off the win. Now, you got to say, it was NAU's race to lose, especially with Kelsey Camille out, and it's true. They kind of dropped the ball. They did not show up. NAU has been dominant all season, and they fell apart in this race. Multiple runners on their team not having good days, very off. Could
Sometimes
have been
hype.
Much better if it was a normal day.
Yeah,
maybe it's the hype. Who knows what?
Pressure.
Their top runner, Elise Stearns, has been just crushing it all year. She ended up third on their team this year, finished back in 20th place, which, you know, that's great. It's a great finish, but She was a top 10 finisher for sure, if not top five. And so it was a disappointing day for NAU, and NC State capitalized and came away with the tight victory.
Well, let's get on to the men's race. That was really exciting. Is the men's race as exciting, Zach?
Well, it's different. Okay, so the men's team race was of higher level of interest in some sense, because NAU's men were going for a fourth straight victory, and they've won six of the last seven NCAA championships prior to this. So major dynasty. They looked set up to do it. But last year, NAU and OSU, Oklahoma State, tied, and it had to go down to a tiebreaker, which has like never happened before. I think there's like one, I can't remember. We did the review last year. How many times has NCAA cross country come down to a tie? Not many. So here this goes down, and then everyone's just kind of wondering, is NAU going to totally crush it, or is OSU going to show up big? Basically, the talk was between those two. But on the individual side, so the team thing we'll get to, but on the individual side, it was like this big mystery. No one really knew what to expect out of this season, because defending champ Charles Hicks went pro, so he's not defending. Kai Robinson of Stanford won the 5,000, 10,000 double in track last year. Historic achievement. But he also then went on to race track all through the summer, like world championships and stuff, representing New Zealand. he had a long, long season. So cross country started late for him. And a lot of times that doesn't bode well. But also, cross country's never been his strongest area. He's certainly better on the track overall than cross country. So that was a big question mark. And then you have others. You've got a transfer, not transfer, but you have a new freshman, new to the NCAA, Haptam Samuel from Eritrea. And he's got like already major accolades in international cross country. So it's like, this dude's a real threat for sure. And then another freshman, Dennis Kipngedich, also with some major international accolades in cross country from Kenya. And, you know, there's Nico Young from NAU. He's always been a threat. And everyone's just wondering, when is Nico Young going to win a title? He's never done it, but he's always right there. When's he going to do it? He was second last year. I think
Isn't he only a sophomore?
No, he's a junior now.
Oh, he's a junior, okay.
But, you know, so it's like, okay, Nico's got it. Young's got to win something eventually, so it could be this one. But there's also Drew Bosley from NAU. He was third last year. He's a senior. You know, seniors are always a danger when it comes to the collegiate scene, and so on and so forth. Lots of questions. But in truth, I must say that a lot of people were interested in the storyline about Graham Blanks from Harvard. For a number of reasons. One, no Ivy League man has ever won the NCAA cross country title. Ever. Actually, I'm not sure that an Ivy League man has won any event in NCAA track or cross country. But certainly not cross country.
Don't look at me. I don't know.
But no Harvard man, certainly. No Ivy League man has ever won cross country, let alone Harvard. So that's a big thing. Like, Graham Blanks has looked strong this season. He won Nuttycombe over the likes of Kai Robinson and others. So it's like, all right, this dude's... he's dangerous. But also, in terms of an American man winning the NCAA cross country title, he's young. And granted, he is a senior. I think he's not actually a senior. He's like a junior, but he's a senior age because he had a redshirt year. So the last time someone that age who is American won the NCAA title was Dathan Ritzenhine. That's like 20 years ago. So that's something. Everyone's like, okay, this is, you know, uncommon, but he's kind of set up to have a possibility. So there's a lot of fascination around Graham Blanks. What's he going to do? How's it going to look? And what it comes down to then is the race was just as exciting as everyone hoped it might be. It was a huge question mark all race long. Early in the race, Drew Bosley and Nico Young, teammates, were kind of like doing a little bit of mix it up and kind of control the race. But not for long, because then mid-race, lead changes started to abound. Lots of things happening. Kai Robinson took over a bit. Looked like he was just looking. Everyone kept saying, oh, he's looking so smooth. Looking so good. But then Haptam Samuel from New Mexico starts turning on some moves, and it's like, oh, well, he's a vet. He knows what he's doing, how to win international level cross country. But Graham Blanks stuck on Samuel and didn't let him go. And the two of them started pulling away, and then everyone's like, oh, wait, that's what Blanks did at Nuttycombe also. And he just stuck on the leaders until the very last. It was like 400 meters to go. Well, at 800 meters to go, Blanks took off, and it was like, oh, he's doing it again. And it, sure enough, Graham Blanks wins the race for Harvard. First Ivy League victory ever in cross country. Youngest American to win the race since Dathan.
Wow.
What a thing. Harvard's in a good place right now. So give you some backstory on that. First of all, Maya Ramsden from Harvard also, she won the 1500 meter title last track season, which is like the only other Harvard title in the NCAA in running, I think, at all. If not at all, it's certainly recently. And Harvard as a team for the men hired a new coach back in like 2019. And prior to his tenure, from 1980 to 2018, Harvard's men had only made the cross country championships once, like in that whole almost 40-year stretch. And then since this new coach was hired, they have made it every year and finished in the top 20.
That's
so it's like,
good.
Hey, they're mixing it up.
Yeah.
He also happens to have been one time a coach at Michigan. So,
oh, well,
there
you know,
go.
Good
All right.
things come from Michigan.
Well, actually, the reason why he was fired from Michigan is because they said, well, you're not doing it the Michigan way.
Oh.
Well, he's doing it the Harvard way, and it's better. Well, I don't know about that, but he's having some success. That's cool. That's exciting. So let me just quickly note the rest of the top finishers for the individual side. Graham Blanks won it. It was Samuel in second. Kai Robinson from Stanford in third. Dennis Kipnigedish from OSU in fourth. Bosley and Young rounded it out with fifth and sixth for the NAU 1-2 punch. But then the team race side. This is where things just got absurd.
Absurd.
Absurd. Okay. So NAU was definitely the favorite coming into the race because they won that tiebreaker last year with OSU, and then they're even stronger this year with a few transfers and things, just looking really good. They've been great all season, but OSU brought in some new international talent who were kind of untried, you know, debuting in the NCAA, but at the same time, veterans in the sport. And so they've got international experience in cross country, super fast track times and things. So everyone's like, okay, if they can clip in to whatever Dave Smith's doing at OSU, they're going to be real dangerous. Well, they turned out to be real dangerous. And at that, things just happened in exactly the craziest possible way. First of all, OSU put five guys across the line in the top 15.
What?
Five guys of the top 15 finishers in the entire NCAA cross country this year. Five of them were OSU.
That's bonkers.
That is bonkers.
Absurd is the word you use.
In fact, absurd. Because you only score five, they scored 49 points. That's the lowest score since 2003. Lowest score in 18 years. And prior to that, there's only been a couple of other times.
Low score wins, for those of you who aren't
low
familiar.
Low score wins. So that's huge. They put five in front of Northern Arizona University's third runner.
That's nuts.
Which was the team that everyone was like, that's the team to beat. Northern Arizona University scored 71 points to OSU's 49. 71 points would have won the NCAA championships almost every year in the last 18 years. NAU has won it six times. They've only scored under 71, like one of those six times. So they should be able to win a championship. They have five guys in the top 25. How do you lose a race with five guys in the top 25? Well, you lose it when the other team puts five and 15. That's how.
Wow.
This is the lowest second place team score since 1963. That's how crazy this was. So OSU takes the title. There's a lot of talk on the message boards about that, whether for or against. Some people are super
Who
fans
cares
of OSU.
Much as
other people are like, they shouldn't have won it because they didn't want them to. Whatever the case may be.
Don't go to the message boards.
It was crazy. It was really something. So just a quick other note here that third place was 125 points further back. So those two teams just owned it. Think about it. 10 of the top 25 finishers in the entire race were from those two teams.
Wow.
Like, that's crazy. So BYU with a good showing for BYU, especially for their team has been on the podium a lot lately. And they turned out, they ran well, but they weren't up there in the same way as those other teams. They ended up third place. One other note that I just wanted to share. Fifth place finisher was Iowa State. Coming into the race, ranked 17th. They just, like, turned it up. That's really cool.
That's awesome.
That's always fun. Stories abound. We're running out of time, so we got to stop there. Yeah. But it was a really exciting meet to watch. We literally paid for the subscription to whatever the thing was where you have to watch it, paid for it so we could watch the race, and then canceled it right afterwards. Whatever that fee was, it was worth it to watch that race.
Yeah. Well, our final bit of news we're just going to do really briefly, but it is a story that could have to do with you because it's a story about how running boosts the lifespan of runners by 12 years.
12 years?
Yeah. There's some new research.
How much do you have to run?
75 minutes per week.
Oh,
is
my.
What they say.
That's doable.
75 minutes per week can add 12 years to your life. That's according to a new study that was published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health.
Okay.
So what they did there was 4,400 subjects, and they compared people who ran 75 minutes to those who ran less than 10 minutes a week.
Okay.
And they didn't, I have to clarify, they didn't measure actual mortality. They looked at cellular aging.
Yes.
So I'm not I'm not a scientist.
There are indicators at a cellular level of decay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what they're looking at when they're looking at it. I thought it was specifically certain DNA markers within the cell.
So it's telomeres, if I'm saying that right. They're the end caps of chromosomes.
That's it.
And so telomeres protect our genetic material during cellular replication and division. So you're able to see if they're shortened or if they're broken down.
Yep.
And so the preservation of these telomeres are what they're seeing as indication for longer lifespan. So that's how they're measuring this.
Yeah.
So it also prevents the risk of various chronic diseases. So it, in short, running regularly can help you increase both your quantity and quality of life.
This is good.
This is good. Another reason to run.
One thing to note, because we always have to talk about this. There are confounding factors because this is a correlative study, not a causative study. Meaning there's no guarantee that it's the running specifically that is causing this because, as you might guess, people who run regularly tend to also have other healthy habits as
That's
well.
True. Yeah.
They tend to eat healthier than people who don't run ever. They also tend to have more things like routine in life and discipline and self-discipline in various life habits. And that's not to say that runners are, you know, the best of all people. Although we might be. But that is to say, a study like this gives you some clarity in terms of correlation, and we always want to associate those things. It's also just, it's really interesting to see, you know, how they detect such things. Mm-hmm. And looking at the telomeres, that's been a way that they've actually been evaluating a number of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Thank you all.
Remember to ask your questions. Send your questions via email to questions@A2ZRunning.com. Do it now. Do it.
Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.